Already remarked on this, didn't I? These were made for a man's lapel. Oh, so now it's made for a woman's lapel. See, sexist, eh? I love being wrong, especially in public. It's very good for me. You want to know how snarky you can get when you travel around a lot, you know, and you act like a comet and you just come in someplace and you hang around and say words of wisdom and go out again? It is such a blessing to be wrong in front of a room full of people. I'm really thankful when it happens. Living with myself, I know. But it's nice to have those gentle reminders. Oh, lots of work still to do, Cecily. Hi. So you all have a right hand? And what does your right hand feel like? What kind of energy? Right shoulder? Right leg? What kind of energy is your right hand? The right side of your face, does it feel different than the left? Is there tension somewhere on the right side of your face? Does it feel like a mask somewhere? Can you all hear me? A vacuum land? Can you hear me at the back? Oh, all right. You feel your right hand. What kind of energy does it have? And your left hand. What does it feel like? Is it a different energy? Does it feel the same? Left arm, left shoulder. Does one shoulder feel larger or smaller or higher than or lower than the other? How about between them, right in the middle of your body? How does that feel? What about the left side of your face? What does it feel like? Does it feel like a mask somewhere? Can you feel the energy of your right hand? Your left hand? You feel energy between your hands from palm to palm if you have your palms facing each other. So compress that energy and join your fingertips together. Compress it into a ball. Join the heels of your hands together. Just bring your little fingers all together in a line. Up your spine is a river of gold light. It represents every moment of aspiration you've ever had. Every time you've seen great beauty or you've wished to have an end to suffering, either your suffering or someone else's, it doesn't matter. There's just this river of gold light running up your spine every moment you've ever had aspiration. Great joyousness of that spirit of your consciousness that can hope, can move beyond. And there's a gold light above your head. You stay with that feeling in between your palms. You're aware of that energy moving up your spine. Gold light above your head. And you make a statement, a naming of your aspiration. Whatever words you want. I use a Buddhist formula. You can say whatever you want. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Sadhu. Well, thank you for turning out, turning in, turning. Before we start tonight, I want to announce that I don't know if you realize, how many of you realize how economical and ecologically minded Buddhists are. I'm not sure that you're aware of this, but Buddhists are very, we don't waste a lot of time. We pack everything into one day, which happens to be the full moon of this month. That's, you know, if you're Christian, you have Easter and Christmas, you know, messy. It's kind of spread out around, but not us Buddhists. Yeah. I want you to understand how wise this is. We have the Buddha's birthday, his awakening day, and the day he did parinibbana. That means he died or left all on the same day, and that's the full moon of this month. Isn't that economical? And you don't even have to, you know, it can change from year to year because it's the full moon of May. Of course, it is true that there is some confusion. In some Buddhist countries, they think it's the full moon of April. And then one or two countries think it's the full moon of June. So we usually settle on May. The middle way, you understand. So as a celebration of that, I understand that the Hayagriva Center is having a puja at 7:30. And there's a Theravadin Buddhist Center, isn't there, in town? And they're having a celebration at 6. And Sadatissa is having a celebration also at 6 o'clock, any one of which you're welcome to. Sadatissa can tell you more about it or his address if you wish at the end of this class or something like that. Is that good? You don't know Sadatissa in the back? He's set this up and done a lot of work. So it's a Buddha's birthday party or a Buddha's awakening day party or a Buddha's wake. Depending on your own mood. Is it on Sunday?
6 o'clock on Sunday.
Oh, 6 o'clock on Sunday. So that makes it, yeah. How un-Buddhist? No, no. Yeah, no, that's lovely. So tonight's topic is about doing meditation retreat and why. Is that more or less right? Have I got it right? Yeah. How many of you in this room have gone on meditation retreats or prayer retreats of any kind? How many of you have not? Gee, you know, that's not bad. Now, how many of you didn't want to put your hands up in either case? One honest person, thank you. Well, there's more than one honest person, but one honest, uncommitting person. I wonder, those of you who have gone on retreats, if there is some particular issue about being on retreat that you feel you would like to ask questions about or have clarified. So if you have any question about that or answer or comment or complaint, would you be so kind as to be generous with it and offer it? And those of you who have not done a retreat but have a question about what it would be like, if you would be so kind as to please give me that question too or offer it, that would be very generous of you. Is that good? Hey, Vacuum Land, you gotta kind of humor me, because I'm from Canada and we're a lot slower there. We don't have that nice warm desert air to keep the brain dry. We get a little mildewed. So every once in a while you have to sort of look at me and say, and then I'm good again. It's sort of the breeze kind of keeps my brain moving from you doing that. Is that good? Will you do that for me? Ah, what a group. I like this. This is wonderful. Yes.
The thing that stops me is that because I really didn't like it after 2 days, whether it's still, you know, really negative pulling out of my home.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That really is, because you really, if you've never done a retreat, and even if you have done lots of them, it's a real act of faith, isn't it, to go on one. I mean, you're really basically putting yourself on a course with someone else in charge, aren't you? And we're not talking about a diet, we're talking about your consciousness. So that's a really good question. Are there other questions, other people? I'd like to collect a bunch of questions and then talk. Is that okay? Okay. The value of it? Okay. Good one. Coming out? Yeah. Uh-huh. So coming back into a city and into your daily life. Yeah. For disappearing. Okay. I'm just reminding myself not to get tempted here when I answer your question.
Please do.
No. Yes. So your question is a bit like Christine's about re-entry.
Yeah. And how to there's always a sense of here I go, I'm getting contaminated. But how to take to not that seems such a negative way.
It is. It is, isn't it? Really nice question. That's very nice. Okay.
The word retreat also brings up the word refuge.
Does it?
Yes.
Okay. I had the great good fortune last year of doing a 4-month retreat. And so because I had all the time I wanted, 4 months, I wanted more, but that's how much time I had. And I had the whole planet to choose from. I chose the Seychelles because almost nobody knows where they are. And it's 4 degrees south of the equator, 1,000 miles east of Kenya. And it's very hard to drop in. And I've done retreats and had people drop in to see how I was doing. there aren't a lot of telephones, very little mail service. So it seemed perfect for me. The water's good. You can eat the food. And it's the tropics. It sounded perfect, and it was. In the last 2 weeks of that retreat, I wanted to explore two things. There were two meditations that I had done some work with them before, but I had a feeling that there was something deeper to get, as there is with any meditation, I'm sure. I'm sure the most simple meditation, you could keep taking it and go back to it, and it would continuously deepen. Because really, any meditation exercise or any meditation object is really only a mirror of some aspect of consciousness, isn't it? Do you understand that, by retreat work? I understand that. That if you're doing meditation well, what you're doing is looking, getting another way of seeing your own being. And if you're doing it really well, you're looking with the eyes of a lover at your own being. That's what should occur. So, in my experience, that's what should occur. So I was really interested in taking two different studies. One of them is called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Do you know the Abhidhamma? Do you know that word? There are three baskets of the Buddhist teaching. One is called the Vinaya Pitaka, which is all the rules of the order. And it tells all the stories of the Buddha when he started walking around and all this motley crew of people just dropped their lives and followed him, you know? Like no respect, you know? They just left everything and started following this guy because he sounded good. He was good, actually. He was very good. And they would follow him around, and you know, their clothes would start getting pretty ragged after a few years, and so they'd take something off of somebody's clothesline. So after a while, when the Buddha would come back to town a couple of times, people would say to him, "We're really glad you're here. Would you mind camping, 10 miles out of town? And we'll visit you." And so then he'd say, "Well, why is that?" And they'd say, "Well, our clothes are disappearing off the clotheslines." And he'd say, "Oh, you beggars, come here." That's what the word bhikkhu means, beggar. Beggars, get over here. Now listen. The only kind of clothes, you see Sadatissa's robes are made out of patches. They're classical. He is a bhikkhu. He is a monk. And the robes are made out of patches because according to the Buddha, the only cloth you're allowed to take if you're going to follow the Buddha is cloth that nobody else wants, like out of a cemetery. You had to go and get the cloth that nobody else wanted, boil it, wash it, dye it all in even color, and sew it together. So traditionally, the monk's robes are made out of patches. That's one of the rules. So the Vinayapitaka is made of all these rules and the story about how it came to be a rule. It has everything you've ever wanted to know about what can happen in a community. You know, every possible human argument is covered in the Vinayapitaka. You know, every bitchy neighbor, every nagging, you know, everybody who knows the right way to do it and how you settle it, everybody who isn't sure whether they want to sit here or sit there, so they put a chair in both places with their hat on each. You know, all that stuff, it's all there. It's quite lovely to read, isn't it? Sadatissa, it's beautiful reading. So everything you ever wanted to know about community life and didn't want to have to live through. So that's called the Vinayapitaka. The Suttapitaka is the herd teaching. This is the Buddhist Bible. It's these three collections, three baskets. All together, there are 44 volumes. So the Vinayapitaka. Now the Suttapitaka is the herd teachings. That's the Buddha walking around for 45 years or so, talking to whoever he meets anywhere, anytime, any place. This is where I told you last night about the shoemaker. He meets this shoemaker who's really angry and he says to him, "Tell me which would be easier, to cover the world with leather or to wear shoes?" And the shoemaker says, "Oh, got it. Stop the anger here. Don't try to." It's pretty exhausting, isn't it? Trying to get the world to line up. So all of those beautiful stories are in the Suttapitaka. The Abhidhammapitaka is kind of like the physics / philosophy of Buddhism, of mind. What is mind? What is body? It deals with three things. What is matter? What is formation matter? What are mind states? And what is consciousness? That's all it talks about, those three things. So it's called the Abhidhammapitaka. And it's one of those things that after you've read it maybe about 20 times, you begin to get an inkling about what it might be about. But it's strangely fascinating nonetheless. Even when you're reading it and you know you don't understand it, there's something that goes, oh, you know what I mean? You know, like if you read a poem that you really like but you don't understand it, and something rings in it and some part of you says, yes. But the rest of you is going, huh? So I have a few times done retreat using the Abhidhammapitaka or a summary of it as the basic guidance for the retreat. Now, in the Tibetan tradition, there is four aspects of foundation work. I am actually going to get to your question. You don't mind my rambling a bit, do you? I am such a rambler. The first of these is called prostrations. And prostrations is physically moving the body from a sense of being present to dissolution into totality, back into being in the present. So moving between form, formlessness, physically moving the body. And it's a whole visualization that goes with it. It's a very, very beautiful meditation. There are two ways to do it. One is for the numbers, to try to get it done, because you're supposed to do 100,000 of them, in which case it's a lot of suffering. The other one is with all of the prayers and really paying attention and trying to understand what is occurring, in which case it is a very transformative meditation. Okay? If you do it just for the numbers, it also is like, what do you call that? That where you hold the body in different positions and things release? It's like de-armoring exercises. It will open and release and so forth, the body. I think you should kind of combine the two ways. The second part called the foundation work, because it opens the foundation of your being, is called the Vajrasattva meditation. Now, Vajrasattva is basically the body of the universe as an enlightened body. Is that clear? If you look at the material realm as the bodily state of enlightenment, that's what Vajrasattva is. Expand on that. In the Tibetan tradition, if you think I'm rambling too much from the point, please just tell me and I'll condense this. Okay, is that good? Everybody agree?
Yes.
Thank you. In the Tibetan tradition, they have this very beautiful, psychologically very beautiful way of working. It's like our mythology, you know, Greek mythology and stuff like that, as a true tool of the psyche. They have created figures or personified aspects of the psyche, which then you begin to interact in dialogue with, and in that process of interaction and dialogue, the consciousness is transformed. It's quite rich and quite powerful way of working. Okay? Three of those figures are called Vajradhara, Vajradharma, and Vajrasattva. Okay? Now, a Buddha, a totally awakened being, the word Buddha means the discoverer, okay, means to discover. Isn't that lovely? So, discoverer of totality, not a bad profession, I've always thought. A discoverer of totality who is Sama Sambuddhasa, which means of absolute fullness with the discovery, and no separateness, what Shakyamuni Buddha was. Okay? Then he died. Well, I'll be. But because he was Sama Sambuddhasa, some aspect of him is not possible to die in one way of being, that such a totality is beyond death, right? You can grasp that logically at least, can't you? Because I'm not going to go into a full mystical explanation of it at the moment, although that would be lovely to do, but not tonight. Hi. Saying hello to Andrew. So what they do is to represent the truth of that experience, which is eternal. The mind of the Buddha, mind aspect of the Buddha, the totality experience, mental, all the cause and effect throughout all existence with no inherent self. Shunya. You know that word, shunya? Means no inherent self. cause and effect, but no inherent self. Totality consciousness. That is called Vajradhara. It's a deep blue figure. It's holding a Dorje and bell, and it represents the mind of Sammasambuddhasa Buddha. That same figure, only red, is called Vajradharma. Represents the speech of the Buddha, that is to say, all energy flows and moves of totality awakening. All passion as totality love. And the body of the Buddha, when it is moved to as a totality archetypal body, is Vajrasattva. There. How's that?
Well, thank you.
So after you do the prostrations, then you do... there's a chair right in the front row here, too, if you want. And then you do Vajrasattva work. And then after you do the Vajrasattva work, to understand the body of totality... Excuse me, I'll try not to giggle. Shameful. Then you do what's called the mandala offering. The mandala offering is very interesting. You take this plate and you rub it 3 times clockwise, that is to say what you are bringing into being, and you name Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then you rub it 3 times counterclockwise and you name Om Ahum, the dissolution of a small self, the awareness of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then you do these piles of rice in 3 levels. And these piles of rice actually represent the universe. But the universe is not the universe. This is the universe. Which is the same as Abhidhamma. So I wanted to do a retreat. I was thinking of doing a retreat where I worked with mandala offering, the traditional practice where you do these piles of rice and you do this visualization and then you dump the rice and you have the visualization of all the grains of rice floating down in front of you and then you build it up again and then you dump it and you build it and dump it and study Abhidhamma together. So I did that. I had a really good time. I recommend it. Now, Seychelles, excellent place to do such a meditation. Highly recommend it. On my list of, you know, retreats, that's a 5-star. And 2 weeks before I finished that retreat, I had this, I suppose one could call it a vision. Every once in a while this happens to me in my life where I get a clear understanding of what the next work is I have to do. And the next work I had to do was the work of ethics, working with ethics in the world. So that's quite lovely for me because to me ethics is simply a matter of love. Isn't it to you? I mean, do you legislate ethics? Or are you honest because it's the only way to really talk about the beloved? I mean, how could you make anything up more beautiful than what is? Right? Does that make sense to you?
It does to me.
So then I went back and I'm going around, you know, I travel around all the time, a little bit here, a little bit there, comet mentality, dangerous stuff. And I'm in one center and we're talking about ethics and everybody's talking about ethics and they're trying to decide what is ethical to them. And you know what they decided? They decided the most important ethical work they could do was that there are 3 families, each of which had a spare room. And all of the different people in that group, they decided that they could support each other for as long as any one member of that group wanted to. Move into a spare room, whichever one of those 3 spare rooms they wanted to move into, to do whatever work they wanted to do a retreat that was important for their life and therefore spiritual. Whether they wanted to study, whether they wanted to do meditation, whether they wanted to pray, whether they wanted to write a cookbook, because for them it was important. Because it was their aspiration, and aspiration is spiritual. And that was their big ethical understanding, that as a community, they could support each other to do retreat and trust people's desire for retreat work. Now, I think that in a community, you have to decide yourself what is valuable. What are the ethics of your community? Are the ethics of your community to support people, to fulfill their lives? I mean, these people decided it was worthy for them to even, one person is a single parent, so somebody else was going to move into their home, take care of the children, other people were going to pay the bills. Do you see? Like, really make a space for everybody to do a practice. Whatever practice they felt was beneficial. And they didn't have, well, of course, you have to do my favorite meditation. Or, this is the only way to practice. Now, in fact, depending on what it is you wish to have happen in your life, there are things that are right to practice. Do you understand that? If you're interested in having this arise in your life, this meditation will do that. If you're interested in having that arise in your life, that study will do that. If you're interested in becoming a plumber, you wouldn't go to Barber's College. That's very straightforward. And so you should know that, that meditation or retreat work is skillful. It's a skill. It's something you work with and develop with an idea of what you want. So if for you it would be really beneficial to be able to get beyond the concepting mind, because the mind that is this mind, this brain that runs this body, is always referring to what you have already experienced, isn't it? It's always just writing the past and bringing it forward so you can see, you know, what you last called something. Nice earrings. How do I know that?
Oh, hanging from ears. Oh, female. Oh, could be male or female. Yeah, but female. Oh, earrings.
Nice earrings. No? All the past experiences, right?
If I'd never seen earrings before, being it's me, I would have been like,
but all the past comes and labels, names everything. And if sometime in your life you want to know who you are without all your past experiences, now that's a big conditioning. It's a really big conditioning. Without all your reactions based on past, you want to know whether that's possible. Now, the difficulty with that is that you still got a body which is conditioned based on past.
Them bones didn't come from nowhere. Let's see you get rid of that conditioning.
But you understand, if you want to say at least cut down the thought so that there is an experience of sensing without too much previous conditioning, then silence is really useful. In fact, I would venture to say it's almost virtually impossible to have a deep experience of a totally new consciousness unless you really cut down the verbalization. Because verbalization and words always refer to what is, was an experience. You have an experience and then the words come. Isn't that true? You hear a bird. What kind of bird was that? What kind of car was that? And some people could tell you, couldn't they, by the sound in the motor. My brother could. So there are times where you really want to just be quiet and see what arises from another part of the consciousness, maybe a more spatial part of the consciousness. And spatially, there is a different experience of communication. There is a spatial type of communication. It's more to do with a mental texture and with a sense of light. You've probably met something of that in experiences like orgasm or when you sneeze. You know, if you pay attention. In both cases. Which is not easy to do, you know, because we're so fond of swooning out, aren't we? Aren't we? Give me my fantasy. Huh? Oh, good, Bliss, I'm leaving. And indeed, in order to integrate the experiences of blissfulness, of deepening of consciousness, back into your daily life, why it's difficult is because you haven't paid attention to the little steps coming back in. Maybe it's too fast. Maybe you need a day of physical work or something to bring the mind back into naming in with the bodily reference point. Often at the end of a retreat, I have people chop wood or dig a garden or do really physical to just give them a sense of naming and in the body. Because that spatial and energy mind gets very powerful, doesn't it? You know, that altered state, that different way of of mentation, consciousness without thought. So that the naming and the working in time can seem like a jolt. If one were going to regard that as a fault, that would be a fault of compassion. Not enough awareness of detail. Does that make sense, Christine? Yeah. You get the same thing from people who insist on meditating with their eyes closed. And then, when they're finished their meditation, it's like, okay, now I'm doing my own private little meditation. Okay, now I'm dealing with the rest of you bastards. You know? It's very subtle. I'm exaggerating it, but it's there. Me and my meditation. Yeah? So if, you might want to watch that because, as my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche, once told me, to experience the transcendence is not so difficult, but to bring it down into the suburbs where you're having a cup of coffee with a neighbor, that's the work. That's the real work. And what the work is, and it always is the work of compassion. Because the Buddha was able to talk to all kinds of people. So that unevenness is very nice. It's a very nice message for you. It's a very clear, succinct message. Yes, the bliss, yes, but where is the compassion? Where is the insight? I remember one time I was... do you like these personal stories?
Yeah.
Because I will stop telling them if you want to get onto something else. I remember one time I was meditating fairly early in my meditation career. I was doing a 3-month retreat, and it was winter in Canada, which means cold, folks. It means cold in Ontario. It means very cold. And I was in this cabin that actually had spaces in the floorboards. So, and this wood stove that was hard to keep it going. So when the wood stove quit, what I would do is, like, I would be just, there would be this kind of heap in the center of the room. That was me in a pile of blankets. And I learned to sit for long hours. See, because it was warm in there. I had a really well-trained bladder, too. And I could sit for a long time. So what happens is you sit for a long time is the one point of concentration gets very, very strong. So the mind gets very powerful at boring in, right? So it's easy to have kind of those altered states of consciousness, like a lot of bliss. It's easy. It's not difficult to get bliss. Very major bliss stuff. So I'm not saying that I'm major bliss. I'm saying it's easy for it to happen. So I'm sitting there and it's like, you know, about midnight. And I'm sitting in this little cabin off in the woods and I just finished sitting and I'm trying to figure out one more reason why I should just stay where I am instead of moving. It's close to midnight. I mean, nighttime is coming. Can I sleep in an upright position? This is the question. It was cold. And being a greed type, we like our comfort. And I'm just sitting there and I'm just looking at the wall in front of me and so a nice convenient thing happens. I start getting absorbed in the wood. The beautiful wood, you know, the knots and the pattern of the flow. And I'm just sitting there really absorbed in the wood. So about 5 minutes pass. And then this thought drifts through the mind because, you know, concentration, not many thoughts. You can see that wood. And I'm looking at the wood for another couple of minutes. And then, yep. And then another few minutes go by. But it's nighttime. Yep. New moon. Yep. No lights here. Nope. I'm shining in the dark. I'm shining in the dark. I mean, Mom always knew I could, you know. Okay, well, that's all very well and good. So the next day, I'm going up to the main house for breakfast. Somebody runs in front of me on the path. This anger comes up. How dare they run? I'm in retreat. Wasn't that interesting? So I can shine in the dark. But what about anger? Huh? Yeah. Oh, how blissful. But what about compassion? None. Not an iota. That was beautiful. That was so clear. You know, because the mind was clear. I wasn't attached. It was like one experience, and I thought, I was a new meditator. And then the next experience, and it was just so clear. Like, this is anger. Why? Because when bliss is interrupted, there is anger. There is contempt. There is like that. So that's very clear. That was very clear for me. Does that help you? Have a sense of that? So what to do about it? Okay, hang on. Yes?
Is that why you do the physical work afterwards?
Yeah.
To change the energy?
Yeah, to bring yourself into, out of the blissfulness, out of just energy bliss, to be able, like that bliss is wonderful. That bliss will bathe you, it will rest you, it will give you good insight. You can use the bliss. But just of itself, it is still a conditioned state. It depends on conditioning. It is not awakening. All it is a slightly better neighborhood. You know? And the taxes are high. You know? And somebody will move in. You can be, it can be guaranteed. It takes work to maintain it, doesn't it? So what you want to do is you want to use that state to bring insight into it. Does that make sense? So how you do that depends on the meditation you're doing. So that's much more a dialogue in private. But to recognize that when the bliss is so strong, run, take a cold shower, work. numerous. And I wish you all the insight to not cause you to cling to the bliss so that you not have more suffering. Because so long as there is suffering, there is no neighborhood safe. Excellent. Tea. So now, what have I covered here? I've covered what kind of retreat. I think that you have to be willing to be where you are, number one. You have to be very honest about looking at who's home, who you are, what your aspiration is. Because I know that for myself, in my early days of meditating in particular, I used to go on retreat and spend most of my time doing anything but meditation. I don't know if you've had that experience. You know, trying to change the weather. Wondering what was for lunch. Wondering if that person over there was more or less awakened than I was. Oh, that's a good one. If I move my leg, would anybody know that I... All that stuff. I know you're laughing because none of you have ever done that. So so you're glad to see me finally being honest for my sins. And indeed I am. And it makes it enormously painful. It's a tremendous suffering to trying for an experience other than that which is present. In fact, in Buddha Dharma, that is considered to be about 95% of the suffering of consciousness, is trying for an experience other than that which is present. It's so simple to say it. But boy, oh boy, huh? When you look at your life, in your daily life, let alone on retreat, trying for an experience other than that which is present, that even applies to that bliss, doesn't it? Wanting the circumstances that hold that and being with the circumstances that don't. You know? So, if you know what it is that you want to accomplish, then you would choose the kind of retreat that will give you that. You know, a wise person understands yidam as interest, I think. What interests you, that's what will lead you on. If you do something of your interest and you watch and you pay attention, very quickly you'll say, okay, well, I've had enough of that. And maybe I'm being very optimistic. Probably I am, but I am optimistic. I think that human beings really do wish to come to fullness of consciousness, really are spiritual. I think human beings really are lovers. I really do believe that. And prefer to be moral, given the opportunity. With just a little education in awareness. Because it feels good to be good. So, therefore, other than basic morality, which I'm not talking about tonight, we can talk about that some other time. Given basic morality, you don't go around mugging old ladies or old men or stuff like that, you know, all that stuff. Given that we all agree on a basic morality, your interest, your aspiration is trustworthy, because if you don't honor it, it's just going to be there, disguised, nagging at you anyway, isn't it? Huh? So honor it, take care of that business, make sure you don't have any other claims, and then you can do meditation. See, renunciation isn't renunciation if it's done out of fear. It's only renunciation if it's done with a full belly. You say, God, that was a great meal. But you know, I still want something. And it's not a great meal. I'm grateful for that. And but if you try to really do the full work of trying to pull in all the energies of your life to that one point, to ask that great, what is it that T.S. Eliot calls it, leads you to the overwhelming question. You want to ask that one overwhelming question. Then you better make sure that there aren't any little side questions or telephones that are going to pull you off. You need to practice on the smaller questions. Get yourself more and more able to trust your ability to question and get an answer. So a whole lot of retreat work is teaching yourself how to ask questions and get answers. How do you tell what kind of retreat to do or what kind of teacher to do a retreat with? You are the employer. You are the employer. Do you know that? Like, you're my employer. Very simple. You don't like me, I don't eat. I don't go to a dentist, I don't have a bed to sleep in. You understand that? You have question about the way I'm teaching. You're the employer. Excuse me, you say. It's about the way you talked about all you bastards there. Now, did you have to use the word bastard, Seth? See, you're the employer, and I need you to do my job properly. Is that really straight? I mean, you really got that? The Buddha said, the teaching and the teachers and the Buddhas are seed. The community is a field. No field, no crop. No seed, no crop. Good seed, rotten field, no crop. Good field, rotten seed, no crop. All lots of variations, aren't there? But you have as much power in a retreat as the teacher does. You must be sure that the teacher understands that, because it's your consciousness. Your precious life. So you test out teachers before you do work with them. You check them out. Put them through their paces. Go and ask them something that you really want to know about. Listen to their information. Go and try it. Go back and answer them. Well, I did this and that happened. Do that before you do a retreat. Or speak to the teacher or whoever is setting up the retreat and say, if I find it uncomfortable, I will want to leave. Is that suitable? Right? You make that very clear right from the beginning. You are responsible for your life. Nobody has more power than anyone else. Isn't that too bad? Wouldn't it be lovely if you could be the victim? But if you want to be a victim, you have to work damned hard at it. Don't you? Now, some people might not agree with me on this, but I'm adamant about this. I'm adamant about this. I've watched people work very hard to be victims. They keep throwing themselves down as doormats. I keep saying, but that's not a door. They say, shut up, don't distract me, wipe your feet. But I'm sitting down. There are three conceits, said the Buddha. Did you know that? The Buddha said there are three conceits. Did you know that? What are they? Huh? Come on. I'm better. What's another one? Oh, you're just so big and strong and wonderful, and I'm so weak, I could hardly... Could you just pass me that glass of water? I can't quite reach it. Oh, no, I don't want to make any trouble for you, but I'm so thirsty. I wish that I could just reach it. It's just like, do you think you could move the table? Oh, I'm so... I am worse than everybody here. And what's the third one? Yeah. Yeah, of course. You understand perfectly what I'm talking about, because we're equal, aren't we? I mean, I have an experience, you have an experience. You ever met anybody like that, who they're telling you? You tell them about, you know, gee, I went to the Grand Canyon, it was incredible. Oh yeah, I saw a movie about it once too, but actually where I went was Bryce Canyon, it was really incredible. I got a new hat the other day. Oh, I bought one 3 years ago, it was really quite a nice experience. I was meditating. It was really interesting. I had this real flash of pink lightning with blue orchids around the corners and this thunder that sounded like Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Oh, yeah, that happened to me. Now, somebody, you can feel them just waiting for you to shut up so they can tell you the same story from their point of view. I am equal. And what do you notice about those three conceits? I see people elbowing each other in the crowd. I don't want to know. And what can you tell me about those three conceits? Exactly. Did you hear, Craig? They're all referenced to the self. The whole universe is always in relation to me. You know, I am better than you. I am worse than you. I am equal to you. Everything is filtered through I. What is my position in terms of what's occurring? Let's call it conceit. In another way of looking at it, it could be called a very weak ego structure. No ability to just be absolutely permeated by an experience and then form out of it. To name it new. No ability to just let go of everything, be vulnerable, and then recreate out of totality in every moment, which is what we all do all the time anyway, don't we? How did I get on to the three conceits? Goodness knows. So now, which questions haven't I answered? I talked about the fear of retreat. Is that clear enough? Do you want me to say more about that? You feel like I've answered you? Yeah. There's lots of different kinds of retreats and lots of meditation teachers, lots of prayer teachers. In this day and age, there's more gurus than you can shake sticks at, aren't there? So a friend of mine in this room who shall be nameless mentioned the other day, I mean, oh yeah, yet another... balding, middle-aged, fat American guru, you know? Immediately I felt my hairline.
Does it show? Does it show? And you know, there's an iota of truth in it, isn't there? Huh? Isn't there? You look at bulletin boards and health food stores and stuff. It's hard, isn't it? I see posters for myself, think, boy, I'd like to hear her talk. I was doing that though in New Zealand. I was reading this poster. This one guy in town, I thought, gee, that sounds really interesting. And there was a poster above it. I just started reading halfway down. I thought, God, that sounds really interesting. It was didn't recognize. Who? Anyway, and I think that's really wonderful that there's so many teachers. It can seem very confusing until you realize that you are the one who has to hear somebody. You might not necessarily like somebody, and they can still be a very good teacher for you. Isn't that true? But something in your heart knows, doesn't it? Don't you think so? You're not going to commit yourself on this, are you? It's the lady behind you, Christine, who asked the question. Oops. What do you think? Do you think that something in your heart knows who you should trust? I think so. I think we all do know. You don't necessarily have to like someone for them to be a good teacher for you. Isn't that true? Although liking them makes it easier. Because what you want is you want to become very adept in non-clinging, compassionate awareness. I know you want that because that's the state of greatest happiness. That's the state of greatest peacefulness for yourself and all beings. That's the most ecologically proper state to be in, which is very important to understand. And that's the state that gives the greatest health to children. Non-clinging, compassionate awareness. It's really hard to fight a war or kill someone if you're in non-clinging, compassionate awareness. It's really hard to tell a lie, commit adultery, you know, all those things. And from a Buddhist point of view, the basic nature of your being is, guess what? Non-clinging, compassionate awareness. So something in you knows that. It vibrates. You might not like it because you might be afraid that maybe you're not worthy of being that. So you might hear that person but really want to get away from them. I certainly had that experience. Maybe one or two of you in the room have had it. I don't know. It's possible. Yeah, I see a couple of nods. So feel free to check and test your teachers. Feel that that's your right, that's your power. Because what you're trying for is the greatest thing of all. And so it requires at least as much shopping around as you do for shoes. So, and then what kind
What kind of retreat? No, no. What about re-entry? We did that. What kind of retreat? I talked about that. About difference between retreat and for replenishing and retreat for retreat. It is quite likely that when someone looks at their life, they realize that everything they have done, they thought they were reaching here and they found themselves reaching there. Huh? They thought they were going to go in this direction, they find themselves going in that direction. Life does have a little bit about of Alice through the looking glass in it, doesn't it? You think you're going in this direction, you find out that's what's happening. Sometimes, in that case, the very best thing you can do is retreat. Just stop moving, sit down, and try to see inside of yourself. What is occurring? What are the aspirations? What are the movements? What are the rises at that time? In those cases, the wisest thing to do is a retreat. When I was in Thailand living in monasteries, I noticed there were quite a few people who were in retreat because it was really comfortable. Nobody disturbed them. Quite a few men. It isn't set up so well for women. But if you really don't want to have a relationship, it's good to be a monk, you know. If you really want to just like meditate and, you know, like shave your head and not, you know, like really like practice like non-involvement, like spiritual, no, don't say that, Cecily. Okay. I told you I made a little mental note to be careful at this point. I'm being careful. Swallow of tea. There is a kind of a very subtle hatred for life or fear hatred for life that can mask itself very nicely in a spiritual gown, can it not? Now, is it wise to interfere with that? That's an interesting question. Just because you don't want them to do that? Like, who are you?
When I'm queen of the universe. I want to make a few changes.
You see, there is one inexorable, how do you say that? Is that close? Rule. And it's called cause and effect. And every one of us have the right in this most compassionate and miraculous universe to do whatever we want with our life, and guess what? That's what will come back to us. Isn't that wonderful? Now, it's quite possible that somebody has spent lifetimes just lining it up, so just this lifetime they can really hate women and anything messy and be a monk and shave their head and not have any hair to worry about. Because maybe that will work. And that's their right. Do you understand? Because life itself will speak to them, hopefully before they die, but sometime or other. So if someone really wants to do something, if you're compassionate, help them along. If you try to change their path, they'll go into a deeper forest. And why shouldn't they? Yeah? Why shouldn't they? Like, who are you? What is it in you and wants to change their path. Is that clear? So that's worth looking at. And also, out of renunciation, you know what the Buddha did? He went there, you know, eating a grain of rice less every day, sitting on nails and, you know, beating himself and all that jazz. And then he realized one day, as he was trying to meditate and his mind kept swooning from hunger, that it didn't work. Like we all learn. And he said that. He said, you know, I practiced all these austerities and they didn't work. My mind was not clear. Well, that's lovely, isn't it? I think that's lovely. We all have the right to learn. This is a lovely school. Do whatever you want. It'll come back. You can trust it. Here's the wind. Spit. And then you say, oh, well, okay, I'll spit this way. And so you spit that way, and somebody turns around and spits back at you, you know. But it's absolutely trustworthy life, isn't it? Absolutely trustworthy. Takes a while to figure that out. Takes a while to figure out that you cannot do anything about what is happening because it is the result of past action. It's already set in motion. It's a result. You can do everything about your reaction and therefore influence what will happen. You are born right in this moment as a result of past action. But who you are giving birth to, that's enormous power. Handle that one first. Don't look at other, look at self. What kind of lover am I? So, with retreat work, the same. Whatever your motive is, that's the result you're going to get. So if your motive is for replenishment, and you really go in there, someone came and did a retreat with me not long ago. She was exhausted, really nice lady. She was quite exhausted, and she was hearing these sounds all the time. So she came into retreat. She said, okay, I'm not going to eat. She didn't talk to me. I knew her daughter. I'd never met her before. And she signed into this retreat center where I was running a retreat and told everybody that she was my student. I never met her. Ha! Tricky woman. And everybody believed her, didn't ask me. So she's there for 2 days before I realize she's there, off in some little room in the temple. And she hasn't eaten. Well, one of my rules is, if you're going to come on retreat, you eat, you sleep, you shit. You're doing those three things, I trust you. It's not, that's true, you wait, you pay attention, you watch, if you teach meditation sometime. Those are the three main things. Someone is in great fear or great unhappiness, those three things go. Right? Nice, normal consciousness you want. Isn't it true? Unless you arrange beforehand with a teacher, you don't fast on retreat. If you're going to fast, you fast. If you're going to do a retreat, you do a retreat. Unless you arrange it. Right? So there she is. She's come on retreat. I don't know her. I know her daughter. Don't know her. She's disappeared. Nobody's seen her since she's booked in. And she's fasting. So I go and see her. Take her a plate of food, being me. I'm always very subtle. Hi, here's your food. Who are you? The gentle touch, you know. And she wants to purify herself because she's so tired. But she doesn't really. She's frightened. And she feels like something's wrong, and she's trying to get rid of something in herself. But her motive is to get rid of something. She's not going to get replenished by that retreat. What the motive is attack. She's going to be weakened by that retreat. So we did some work. For example, she ate. And she actually was replenished by the retreat. But it was because she started looking at, she had this voice in her head about she should fast, she should purify herself. And I suggested to her that a democracy was a good idea, she should ask her toes. And she thought that was reasonable and did, and her toes wanted to go for a walk, not do yoga. Because she was doing really extreme yoga and not eating and, you know, hiding in the room. And so then she started working with that, and she was hearing sounds. She'd been hearing sounds for about 4 months. So I suggested, and it scared her, and that was part of what she wanted to purify. So I suggested she make the sound and see where she could hear it right through her whole body. And then she had this whole experience of like this angelic thing happened, and then the sounds went away. And from that, from something that was trying to come through the consciousness, which scared her, and her trying to do a retreat to rejuvenate herself, but in fact to try to control what she didn't understand, to actually being curious about who she was, and not only what she thought she should do, but being curious about, you know, what mysteries there were in her toes. There was an actual rejuvenation, sudden birth of a real understanding of spirituality in her life. She's very Christian. And she's really happily Christian when she left the retreat. So rejuvenation is a wonderful thing to have happen on retreat. But you have to watch. Sometimes when people say they're on retreat because they want to be rejuvenated or this or that or the other, it's really because they're hanging on to one idea and they're going to go for it. Now, if you're their teacher, you might be able to say one thing or the other about that. Most of the time, you probably say, okay, by the way, you might like to take this parachute. But sometimes you just say, yeah, that's right, because you can see that that is fine. That is going to take them where they want to go. But if the person is not in touch with their whole body, that's when I think retreat work can be dangerous. Do you agree with me? There is no substitute for being aware of your body. Any meditation, any prayer is dangerous if you try to get out of where you are. You have to start by awareness of what is. And then you move that. Anytime anybody goes mad in meditation, most of the time, I'm just going to blanket statement. It is because they are split from the body. It is because they think it's somehow spiritual to control, change, right, the body. And you don't even know how your body was made. Like, let's say you make a liver, folks. Wait, who in this room can make a liver? Right, but you've all got one. Right? Where'd it come from?
I don't know.
So there is in your body a wisdom that's a little bit more profound than your brain, isn't there? Yeah. I know I haven't exactly answered your question, but have I sort of poked around at it enough to satisfy you? Thank you. You're very gracious. Whose question haven't I answered? I did. I said any kind of retreat. Yeah, I did. Remember me saying at the end of that whole long thing, I said, it depends on what the person's aspiration is. Because given a basic morality, any aspiration will lead to the aspiration. There's no place else for us to go. We're all only interested in one thing. Let's not quibble about terms. You know, this teacher says it this way, that teacher says it that way. The only danger really is sectarianism. Because, you know, one of the last conceits to fall is the conceit not in a self, but in a path. I can't tell you how many wonderful teachers I have had the great honor of practicing with, each of whom have told me that they know theirs is the only way. Well, that's probably enough, is it? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Somebody raised a question about refuge.
Oh, yeah, refuge. Great, thank you. Yes?
Hearing you talk about teachers and gurus, as you said, that teachers having the only way. The issue is self-importance.
Those teachers, by the way, did not feel self-important at all. But they had absolute knowledge that the way they had traveled worked. And so it wasn't self. It was their path. It was their understanding. It sounds like there's no difference, but there's a big difference. You can feel when somebody is self-oriented. None of these people were self-oriented. But their knowledge of the way they went is one of the last fetters to fall from a Buddhist point of view. And so you can learn a great deal from someone who feels that their path is the only way. But realize that that's one of the last conceits to fall. And don't get caught in sectarianism.
So you're describing conceits within the context.
No, in this case I'm not. I'm talking about a more subtle form of conceit. Not a self. But in this case it's no longer a self because the sense of self is one of the first things to fall. The belief in a permanent self goes very quickly. But the awareness of the path, the cause and effect that has led to insight and to compassion. This and this and this works, that and that and that doesn't. Then when you meet people who are suffering, you really want them to be free of suffering. So you say, look, do it this way, it works. You know?
Every father wants his son to join the family business, eh?
Because it's a safe way, you know. Eat this mushroom, you'll survive. Don't eat that one, you'll die. It's like that. It's like that sense of this is safe. This is a way. Is that clear? Okay. And thank you. Refuge. Refuge means to realize that the universe hasn't made any mistakes. You practice refuge until you realize it. You practice refuge. That is to say, you can practice it by devotion or you can practice it spatially. When I'm teaching meditation and I don't know a lot of the people who are there, I generally do it spatially. That is to say, image above your head, about this high, a foot and a half above your head, a gold light right there. Got it? Now one below your body. Got it? Now one in front of you. Behind you. You doing this? to the right, to the left, the four quarters. All those lights join up. You're sitting in an egg of gold-colored light. That's refuge. You create a space, and within that, a mental space, and within that space, you say, okay. It's like, okay, I'm going to make a cake. And you don't start breaking the eggs and tossing the flour on the counter. You have a bowl. Then you create, have a bowl within which you practice safety. You practice within that bowl a state of non-clinging, compassionate awareness. And then when you're good at it, the boundaries move out. Now, there are a lot of ways of practicing refuge. One is through devotion, for example, being aware of someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Have you ever met him or had connection with him? Did you have a sense of joy about that? So then when you remember him, that sense of being joyous, which is a protection and a refuge, joy, love is the only refuge, really. Now don't you kill that bug. We're talking about refuge. Jeez. Okay? So when you see someone like that and a sense of joy and energy arises, that's devotion. And that's refuge. I don't know if you ever read Denial of Death. Did you ever read that book? Beautiful, beautiful book. Very worthy of read. It won a Pulitzer Prize, I think, many years ago. Really worthy of reading. But in it, this man spent some time in concentration camps, came out a saint. I'm not joking. Wonderful, joyous being, huh? And he talks about the people that survived well were the people who had someone they loved, that they thought of. You see? As soon as you thought about someone you love, you're protected. Because of the love. So to recall the Buddha, or to recall Christ, or to recall the Dalai Lama, or for a scientist, recall Albert Einstein or David Bohm. You know, an architect, recall Frank Lloyd Wright. Who knows? You know? You understand? A writer, recall Gertrude Stein. You know? Who said who's that? Oh, God. Well, you have to come to the poetry one. Is that, do you think that's decent? Okay. Is that good? I want you to understand something, that the thought of something beloved or peaceful or recreating the womb surround, recalling that sense, is a power, is an energy. And when you pray for someone, you just image them surrounded by light. And that is a power, it is an energy. You don't pray for them to get anything. You just surround them with light. And it works, it has great power, it will see you through. You can work with different colors of light, but gold light is very good. If you wake up every morning and put gold light in the 10 directions, if you go to bed at night and you put gold light in the 10 directions, I think you'll find it very interesting in your life. There is prayer, there is spirit, there is love. They're tangible, real, workable things, and your consciousness should be working with them. Because that's what you're on about. You're a human being. What a celebration. Well, that's enough of that, isn't it? Did I not answer anybody? It's warm in here, eh? Same, there's a gold light in your heart. You notice that? spreads through your body, through your head, down your arms and legs, pours out through your pores in all directions, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, four quarters. Moves through walls, through the earth, through the atmosphere. Just washes out everywhere, and wherever there is suffering caused by willful or unwillful ignorance of body, speech, or mind, this gold light just temporarily assuages it. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.